south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, I got to tell you, once again, I was very disappointed today. I went to the market. You know, they've got a lot of big-ass fruit, vegetable, and, well, everything markets down here. So anyway, over the years, I've turned into an avocado guy. You know, they're called aguacates down here. Agua meaning water. Cate meaning, well, that's what they call it anyway. Aguacates. And I think the original Aztec or Mayan, whoever named these things way back when, put the word agua or water in the name. Because many of them, when you take a bite, are loaded with water and actually have no taste at all. It's like eating a soft, sort of mushy vegetable impregnated with water. Now, of course, without a doubt, there are some avocados that are absolutely scrumptious, like pure high-grade butter. Just a fantastic taste. Maybe only 2 or 3 out of 5, though. The problem is you never know until you bite into one if it's going to be great, mediocre, or bland and watery. Thing is, if an avocado is whole and you haven't cut into it, it's impossible to tell what it's going to taste like. Unless, of course, you've tasted one already from the same tree. That's one of the only consistent markers. Avocados from one particular tree taste pretty much the same. So, once again, you can't tell by looking at an uncut avocado. However, once you've cut into one, just by seeing inside, suddenly you've got much better predictability odds. But seeing isn't always believing either. It takes a lot of experience looking at an avocado that's been cut open to make a good guess whether it's going to be a really great tasting one or one that tastes like a piece of fruit infused with water. I've noticed myself after cutting into who knows how many thousands of them that some of the really good tasting ones, not all, have a deep yellowish green. And the yellow part, almost golden, takes a practiced eye. So in the end, trying to estimate what an avocado is going to taste like is kind of like estimating what a watermelon will taste like. Same thing. The only way you can really predict is if you've tasted a watermelon off the same vine. You can't tell by cutting one open or thumping it. You've got to dive right in and eat one. So anyway, I was at the big market. I bought a half dozen avocados, got them home, cut one open, and I was very disappointed. Sort of like a bland piece of fruit infused with water. So what do you do then? Well, time for guacamole, or as they say it here in Spanish, guacamole. At least then you can add crap to spice it up. By the way, anytime you're at a big market, there'll always be a cut open piece of fruit or vegetable, whatever they have on display out there. And the vendor will be giving out samples. I never take samples. And no matter how good they look, neither should you. Unless you want to roll the dice with old King Montezuma. Are you feeling lucky? And why not? Well, all you have to do is stand around for a while and watch how the vendor cuts it up. And you'll never ask for a sample again. He or she'll take a knife that they just wiped off on their pants. Then start slicing up a sample. In the meantime, they'll pet the dog or pat a little kid's greasy head. There's always little kids around you. Then, maybe scratch an itch with the knife blade, slice off a hangnail maybe, then get back to cutting up the rest of that avocado or fruit or vegetable sample. Though obviously you'd be absolutely sure if an avocado is good or bad by taking a piece that he's offering, but as for me anyway, it's not worth risking the wrath of Montezuma. So then why am I bringing this up? Well, there's an opportunity here, because it's always guesswork with unpeeled avocados. For any of you creative mechanical types out there, well, whoever comes up with a portable avocado quality scanner, which most probably will be an app on your cell phone, where you could run the device across an avocado to map or quantify the density of the thing, well, let me tell you, if you could market that thing, you'd be a millionaire in no time. A multimillionaire. Because if there's one thing I've determined about avocados, the ones that have the most dense consistency, in other words, the ones that weigh the most per volume, thus have the least amount of water, have the best taste. Look, it should be easy to come up with a scanner to just detect density. Man, there's 100 different kinds of scanners out there for lungs and bones and brains and fetuses. Look, dentists scan teeth and dermatologists scan skin. Ophthalmologists scan eyes. And people with IQs less than 80 scan you and me at the airport. I'm telling you, all you need is a software engineer, a materials engineer and someone who knows about basic scanners. And I bet you could come up with something that's an app on your phone in a couple of months. Probably something sonic, like a mini sonar. Then, after that, you modify it a bit for watermelons. In fact, any kind of melon. Or maybe have all that built into one device. Anyway, just saying, I'm surprised no one's given it a shot yet. Believe me, if I was still 20 or 30 years old, I'd be calling a meeting with some of my nerdy friends who are a lot smarter than I am. And we'd be the produce scanner kings. Funny thing, too, I think about that every time I go to the big market looking for fruits and vegetables. I'm thinking, why can't I download a produce scanning app? Or why can't I buy an individual device like that from Amazon? Sooner or later, someone's going to market one. I hope it's sooner. I mean, look, just think of all the fresh produce you bought all your life that looked great on the outside but disappointed you in the end. How many times have you eaten a watermelon or any kind of melon that had no taste or just tasted like cardboard? And how much would you pay to eliminate that possibility altogether? To have an app on your phone or a lone standing device? $50? $75? $100? I'll tell you, when they finally have an app, it'll probably be $5 or maybe even free. The question is, though, what about the secondary effects? What happens to the food that gets rejected? Well, it goes to hospitals, nursing homes, and the military, of course. When consumers can reject a piece of fruit or vegetable at the point of sale, well, that's certain to change the food industry completely. It'll probably usher in a multi-tiered price spread. You'll just automatically pay more for the stuff that scans up best, and less for the hospital, cafeteria, school, lunchroom, and military-grade stuff. Anyway, just a little hypothetical brain exercise there. I hope it comes to pass soon, though. We'll see. All right, moving on. Have you read the latest scandal coming out of Mexico? This is a new one. Not at all your typical extortion rackets, kidnap the tourist, people disappearing, gangbanging, fentanyl stuff. Nope, none of that. This time it's a gringo and expat healthcare scare. Try saying that three times really fast. Healthcare scare, healthcare scare, healthcare scare. Anyway, the latest slew of articles on this subject came out yesterday. For example, this article. It starts off, federal and Texas health officials are alerting Americans and clinicians about suspected cases of fungal meningitis among U.S. residents who traveled to Matamoros, Mexico. The article states at least 4 U.S. patients are hospitalized and one has died. All 5 patients traveled from Texas to the border city of Matamoros to get surgical procedures done that involved an epidermal, which is an anesthetic injected into the area around the spinal column. All patients were women in their 30s to 50s undergoing cosmetic procedures, all between February and April 2023, with toxic symptoms coming 3 to 6 weeks after surgery. It says authorities believe there are many more cases that have not yet been reported because symptoms show up weeks later. The article further states that travelers with these fungal spinal infections have had medical or surgical procedures, including liposuction, at specifically 2 clinics in Matamoros, Riverside Surgical Center and Clinic K3. Then it says health authorities in Tamaulipas State, where Matamoros is located, ordered clinics to stop performing surgeries this week and plastered signs saying suspension of services and activities posted at the clinic's entrances. Then it says when journalists and investigators tried to call the 2 telephone numbers for the K3 clinic, Luis Hernandez Ruiz answered the phone, a doctor who works at the clinic, saying, "I understand we're being investigated. Nothing has been confirmed yet." Then he stopped talking and the line went dead. By the way, meningitis is a swelling of the protective covering of the brain and spinal cord. It can be caused by bacteria, virus, fungi, or trauma. Common symptoms include fever, headaches, stiff neck, nausea, vomiting, confusion, and sensitivity to light. And it can be accidentally introduced during a medical or surgical procedure, spreading from somewhere else in the body to the brain or spinal cord. Meanwhile, the Texas Department of State Healthcare Services said in a statement, quote, "It's very important that people who've had recent medical procedures in Mexico monitor themselves for symptoms of meningitis. Unfortunately, that can come weeks after the procedure. It's a life-threatening illness that must be treated immediately when symptoms arise." Texas healthcare officials say that people should consider canceling or postponing any elective surgeries in Mexico, including liposuction and other procedures that involve epidermal anesthesia. And in a news release, Texas officials are urging residents who have had surgery involving epidermals they may have had to contact a stateside doctor for updated information. All right, me, Johnny, here. You've probably heard about those news reports, right? Now, of course, this just might be a tempest in a teapot. When it's the last time you heard someone use that phrase, tempest in a teapot. Probably some old black and white British drawing room farce, huh? Anyway, I'm saying it might be a tempest in the teapot because there are tens, if not hundreds, of thousands of elective medical procedures done in Mexico every month. And so far, only 5 cases of spinal meningitis, all coming from 2 particular clinics in Matamoros, Mexico. So to me, it's just looking like a bad batch of anesthetic. And I bet those anesthetics come from India or China. So anyway, I wouldn't go crazy or freak out about this story now. Not yet, anyway. Though for sure, I wouldn't go to Matamoros, Mexico in the near future to have any kind of surgery done. Because, you know, Matamoros is ground zero for the problem. So then why am I bringing it up? If I'm thinking it's just overblown and it's no big deal? Well, because of the email I'm about to read to you and some other emails I've been getting lately. I've got quite a little pile here. This is stuff you're probably only going to hear on this show. You know, we often talk about healthcare for expats and gringos. I mean, really, it's an important topic. If you're going to have a plan B down here in Latin America, you're going to have a healthcare plan, you're going to have a doctor or a couple of doctors, and someday you're going to end up in a clinic. We all do. The older you get, the more that becomes your fate, right? So I'm going to read this email so you know what you're in for. This comes from Dr. P. He says, "Dear Johnny, as a dentist in Texas, I have a few controversial things to add to your rants about medical tourism south of the border. Number one," he says, "if you pop down to Mexico for laser tooth whitening, it's marketing hype. The laser desiccates or dries your teeth and makes them appear whiter than they really are. That'll last for a few weeks or months. The color, the natural color, will come back. This at first gives patients the impression that the teeth whitening worked better than it actually did. Patients are almost always disappointed after a couple of months." He says, "I charge $300 for a real bona fide in-office whitening in my office. However, most people in my neck of the woods can jump right across the border and get their teeth whitened for $100 in Mexico. But you wouldn't believe how many of them trickle back into my office after 6 months or so and pay $300 to get it done right. What I'm going to tell you next may be controversial, but I'm telling you it's the truth." He says, "Of course I advertise. When you're close to the Mexican border, you have to, because Mexican dentists advertise everywhere. And the draw for patients to go south of the border is all about the price. People think a dentist is a dentist, and that's it. But that's not it. Speaking of ads, my best performing ads are for patients who had treatment done in Mexico and need it fixed or redone. In fact, I've done the numbers, and my return on investment on these ads averages 12 to 15 times my advertisement cost." He says, "As an American dentist on the Texas southern border, personally," he says, "I love Mexican dentists because redoing their work is extremely lucrative for me." He says, "No other marketing that I do performs better for me than my Mexico redo ads. So in that respect, I have nothing negative to say about dental tourism at all because it generates most of my business for me. However, I have to admit, 20 or so years ago, when dental tourism first started happening, it did put a scare into us American dentists along the border. In fact, at our dental society meetings, we even had big talks about it. There were some dire predictions about our economic fate that never materialized." Then he says, "I admit that prices are ridiculously high for dental treatment here in the U.S. due to all the regulations, staffing, insurance, and certifications. But you do get what you pay for, mostly anyway. For example, in Mexico or Costa Rica or any third world country that advertises medical tourism," he says, "beware of ads plastered in English. The point being, when a medical practitioner plasters signs out there in English, then most if not all of his patients will speak English and not Spanish. That means most all of his business is coming from people living in the States. Often they live many hundreds of miles away because of the distance and the language barrier. Americans are unlikely to come back and complain. They don't want to make the trip back across the border once again. The farther a first world person travels to get medical tourism in a third world country, the less likely are the complaints and callbacks. Even if there are plenty, that person will seek to have his problems resolved with a dentist or physician closer to home. So my advice, avoid doctors and big clinics that have all their signs and ads in English. Also," he says, "in my experience, I would shy away from getting crowns and bridges in Mexico or any third world country because they usually end up with decay or needing root canals. He says, I often see this months later when people come back for checkups in my office. He says, the most important thing about a crown or bridge is the margin where it seals at or below the gum line. And as you always say, Johnny, details, details. That's what Latin Americans lack. And that particular detail at the margin of the crown at the tooth, at the gum line or below, makes all the difference whether the crown lasts 20 or 30 years or 5 years. Then Dr. P says, you know, Johnny, I've probably replaced 500 faulty crowns from Mexican dentists over the last 10 years due to such recurrent decay or so-called open margins right at or below the gum line. And patients, they don't know what margins are. The thing is, Johnny, at American dental schools, we're taught to be very particular about those margins where the tooth meets the gum line. That's the critical area for future decay and infection. That's only something you could detect with a probe or x-rays. Everyone who walks out of a dentist's office with a beautiful, shiny white crown never thinks about the margins. They don't even know about margins. All they really care about is if it looks nice and didn't break the bank. Now, Johnny, for the good news. There are beautiful dental offices in Mexico located in designer buildings for a quarter the price in comparison to U.S. dentists. There are fine dentist offices south of the border with amenities you'd find in New York, Miami, etc. I agree with exactly what you've said in past shows, Johnny. In order to get a good one, you must do your homework. Look at the diplomas on the walls and go with the guys who got their degrees at U.S. dental schools. Why? Because they teach you about making those smooth, tight, perfect margins on crowns. However, he says, I wouldn't go into certain dental offices in the U.S. either. In fact, he said, I did an internship with a dentist for 1 year after I got out of dental school. He was a very, very nice, congenial guy. $1 million practice, too. His patients absolutely loved him. But only I knew he was a terrible dentist technically. And I saw him doing bad dentistry every day. And one day, when I was working on his teeth, you know, dentists have dentists too. Well, guess what? When I was working on his teeth, he asked me if he was a good dentist. I lied and said he was because I was put on the spot and was working in his office. Imagine me, low man on the totem pole, telling him he should have been a plumber. That would have caused a huge rift in our personal and professional relationship. Yet another time he told me in confidentiality he had to repeat a year at dental school. Yes, that's right, and it shocked me because when I was going to dental school, I remember in my class of around 100 kids, three people also had to repeat, and we all knew why. They were sort of clumsy, technically, not something you want your dentist to be. But patients never know that stuff. Where can you get information on a physician or dentist who flunked a year? Try nowhere. Yet this guy, like I said, had $1 million practice. Why? Because he was a really nice guy. You know, medicine and dentistry just might be the only two professions where personality trumps technical prowess any day. Because unless the guy's a real hack, patients are clueless. Funny thing too, that dentist I worked for never got sued. People don't sue nice guys. Ask any malpractice attorney. In medicine and dentistry, the thoughtless, arrogant a-holes get sued 10 times as much as the nice guys. Then he says, bottom line, the public has no idea if a dentist is technically good or not. They judge a dentist by three things: the pain or comfort level, the cosmetic look, and the price. So the best way for a patient to judge is, like you said on your podcast, Johnny, look for cleanliness, like in the bathrooms. Look at the diplomas. Don't be fooled by American diplomas either. Look at the fine print because it just might have been a weekend course. Make sure if they've got a specialty like oral surgery, periodontics, or orthodontics, it's a year or two of graduate studies, not a weekend course. Have a look at the fine print on those diplomas, which almost no one ever does. Oh, and get this. Then he says, by the way, Johnny, my wife is Mexican, a nurse with an educated family, and she tells me how her and her family would only go to hospitals, clinics, and doctors in Mexico that had doctors that graduated from American schools. They analyzed those diplomas too. Oh, and by the way, Johnny, your listeners should also know, a Latino physician or dentist who does have a diploma from an American dental or medical school only had that opportunity because he was top in his class at his medical or dental school in his home Latino country. So, for example, if you're south of the border dentist, graduated from dental school at Guadalajara University, and got his periodontics degree up at Tulane in the States, you can rest assured he was top of his class, a go-getter, a detailed person, or he never would have been a candidate for a graduate position at Tulane. Then he signs off, "You're providing a great service, Johnny." Signed, longtime listener, first-time writer, Dr. P. Good one, Dr. P. Just one thing, though, Doc. I get that you're warning people not to just blindly go to Mexico for medical and dental tourism. I certainly get that. You have to do your homework. I agree. Though I guess you're saying it's all right to go to Mexico and find yourself a wife, right? Oh, and Dr. P, just to add to some of those medical and dental horror stories south of the border. Many years ago when I was in Costa Rica, a friend of mine from Canada, his wife needed some bridge work done. And, you know, Canada has national health, but not for dentistry. At least, not back then. Anyway, I remember one day down in Costa Rica, she was bragging at a party how she had some bridge work done in Costa Rica for something like a fifth or a sixth of the price of what she'd have paid if she had it done up in Canada. Well, guess what? About a year and a half later, she had some pain and some swelling around that bridge. She was back up in Canada for a visit. She went to a dentist. He told her the same thing Dr. P warned us about in his email today. He said the margins on the crowns on the bridge work were faulty. In other words, where the crowns met the gum line or right below the gum line, there were wide open gaps that you couldn't see unless you probed it or looked at an x-ray. Bacteria had lodged in there and it got infected. She had to have a bridge removed, completely redone. And today, she admits one of the dumbest things she ever did was having cheap dentistry done in Costa Rica. And though she says the office was nice, she never looked at the diplomas. That was her first and most serious mistake. By the way, speaking of medical conditions, did you know I'm afflicted with a serious disease? It's called restless leg syndrome. Now, of course, I didn't know I had it. Since as a kid, I always kind of bounced my legs up and down. My mom said I started doing it as far back as kindergarten, they tell me. No one ever said anything, didn't seem to bother anybody. You'd think for sure if it really was a problem, I went to Catholic schools and nuns would have been all over me. They'd have whacked me with the pointer. Or just grab me with a deep knee clutch. You know, the nuns would do that on your shoulder, too, if you weren't sitting up straight and they didn't like your posture. But nope, I didn't know I had this terrible disease till just a couple of years ago, when I started reading about how lots of people had it and many, many people were on prescription medicines for it. In fact, I just came across a big article in the medical review literature. Got it right here. It says, restless leg syndrome, known as RLS, also called Willis-Eckenborn disease, WED. Let me read a piece of it to you. It says, it's a sleep and neurological sensory condition, meaning it's related to your nervous system, which includes your brain and spinal cord. It's an urge that causes your leg to move. Oh, how scientific. 7 to 10% of people in the U.S. experience RLS, it says. Goes on to say, symptoms of restless leg syndrome often worsen during periods of inactivity. Then it says, healthcare providers classify restless leg syndrome as primary or secondary. Primary RLS, known as idiopathic RLS, means it basically has no cause. However, many people with idiopathic RLS have a family history of the condition. So I guess you newlyweds out there, if one or both of you has RLS, you should skip having kids. And if you slip up, maybe abort. I mean, really, you wouldn't want to inflict that toxic genetic mutation on any future generations. Oh, and there's a type 2 RLS called secondary RLS. It's designated for people who have RLS that's from a known cause. Like, for example, way too many cups of coffee. Starbucks syndrome, huh? Oh, and as an aside, it says about 11 to 29% of pregnant people experience symptoms of restless leg syndrome. Notice how they said pregnant people, because, you know, men can get pregnant these days. RLS during pregnancy, it says, usually resolves within a few weeks after delivery. Okay, so there's another option. Maybe I'll get pregnant. Then it says the symptoms of RLS can vary in severity, although most people's symptoms get worse later in the day when the urge to move your legs gets stronger. It says if you have moderate symptoms, you may have the urge to move your legs a couple times a week. And with severe symptoms, you might find you have the urge to move your legs many different times a day. Some of the causes of RLS, number one, anxiety. Number two, depression. Number three, difficulty in concentrating. Number four, extreme fatigue and daytime sleepiness. Number five, memory problems. Number six, mood changes. though it says your restless leg symptoms might go into remission at any time, maybe increase or disappear for a period of time and then reappear at a later time. About 70% of people with restless leg syndrome experience progressively worse symptoms over time. Symptoms might also move to other parts of your body. It may progress and you might get restless arm syndrome or restless nose, ear, eye, navel, or restless hair syndrome, all of which can be diminished through proper pharmacological interventions. Oh, and get this. I'm so glad I read this article. I'm so relieved. It says people assigned female at birth are more likely than people assigned male at birth to experience restless leg syndrome. There also seems to be a genetic component as well. As mentioned, about 65% of people with RLS have a family history of the condition. And there's about an 80% correlation with identical twins. In other words, when one identical twin has RLS, there's an 80% probability the other will have similar debilitating symptoms. Then it says, there are not any specific tests to diagnose restless leg syndrome. However, your healthcare provider can inform you about your possible treatments and pharmacological interventions. Bottom line, if you have a strong, sometimes overwhelming urge to move your legs, there are medications and pharmaceutical interventions that can help. Oh, and children get it too. Unfortunately, though, diagnosing children with restless leg syndrome can be challenging because young children, especially embryos, may not be able to adequately describe their symptoms. Not a problem, though. Big Pharma has medications for them, too. Finally, it says medication is typically the primary treatment. First and foremost, anti-seizure medications. Second, benzodiazepines, you know, Valium and Xanax. And lastly, opioids. Yep, both doctors and pharmaceutical companies recommend if you have RLS, restless leg syndrome, one should take opioids and take them often. And finally, it says, living with restless leg syndrome can be difficult, but there are support groups. Therapy is often recommended as well, especially for those victims who've been cruelly leg shamed. Anyway, so there you have it. I just thought I'd lay it all out for you. I'm a sick puppy. Didn't know how sick till I read about it. I'm just so glad Big Pharma and woke doctors can treat it. So glad they caught it early before I needed an intervention. I'm just so grateful I'm living in the 21st century because before the millennia, it was all in the closet. That's right. The disease known as restless leg syndrome, that scourge so many of us suffer with? If you don't have it, how could you know it's worse than a heart attack and more devastating than cancer? I'm just so glad Big Pharma's got a pill for it.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.